So we've heard some incredibly inspiring and exciting stories from partners in other sectors. What my job today is to talk a little bit about how does this all look from the perspective of a public health practitioner in an urban health department. I'm the chief of our chronic disease and injury section, and I'm the PI of our Communities Putting Prevention to Work grant. I have no disclosures. And so, as we've heard, CDPW is pretty unique. It's a one-time, never-to-repeated opportunity where we have lots of money and very little time to make some big changes in our community. So the real question is it relevant to everyday public health practice? Is it going to be a flash in the pan and a one-time event, or is it really going to help us come up with a new paradigm for doing public health work at the state and local level? And I think my experience living through 18 months of it is yes, it actually has some really important lessons that we can take forward into our work in the future. And I'll focus on four of the things that we found have worked quite well in CPW, and they were now integrating into our work throughout our public health department. One is, as you've heard, the policy systems and environment, or PSE change. The other is working across sectors, also developing the skills, tools, and best practices to do this kind of work. And finally, how this all feeds into building a movement to make change and lasting change at a large scale. So why PSE change, policy system environment change? You've heard some of the rationale from Becky already, but it really affects many, many people. In King County, the work that we've done has let us reach literally hundreds of thousands of residents in our community to help them have healthy places to live and to make the healthy choice the default choice. It's cost effective. Instead of educating, for example, and providing one-on-one services, we are now able to have public health staff work on policies and system change that affects many, many people. And it gives us the tools to address the social and environmental determinants of health that are the fundamental drivers of health inequities in our community. And finally, it's a chance to do some sustainable work. How many times have you written grants and thrown up your hands at that sustainability section of the grant, knowing full well the funding's going to go away and what's going to be left? Well, by making a policy or a systems change or changing an environment, these changes will last even after the particular initiative goes away. Some maintenance might be necessary, but the fundamental change has been made. I just wanted to give you a sense, and I won't go through all of these in detail, of what kind of things you can accomplish with at the local level doing this kind of work. Our Board of Health got really invigorated and activated by the opportunity to come up with land use guidelines that are now being incorporated into comprehensive plans that contain healthy elements around built environment and food access. They've also issued vending guidelines. We have complete streets plans adopted by 8 cities by the end of the project. Our local science museum or science center has a new exhibit funded by CPW that will show the value of prevention. And so on. You can read the list here. I won't go through all the details, but just wanted to show you that this does work. In tobacco, similarly, the Board of Health has been able to take further steps towards regulating smoking in public places and regulating the new e-cigarette phenomena. Our school districts, for example, have been able to pass policies on alternative suspension for tobacco use. If you suspend a kid for tobacco use, that affects academic performance, so tobacco rules are not enforced. But if you find an alternative to suspension, then you can actually start enforcing tobacco policies. And many, many places have become smoke-free, including hospitals and mental health agencies and their clients, smoke-free parks, affordable housing. Let me give an example on the affordable housing smoke-free units. We will have 10,000 smoke-free units. We have 7,000 now by March 2012, thanks to CDPW. This took a commitment that CDPW was able to catalyze among public housing and nonprofit housing developers and who provide affordable housing. Similar to what we've heard from our colleagues in other cities today, there was initial skepticism. The residents were not like this. However, we were able to provide surveys of residents to show indeed that 77% of the residents wanted smoke-free housing at their public housing and low-income housing sites. This, in turn, let us go and work with the agencies and the residents to educate them about the benefits of going smoke-free. And we were able to also offer cessation support resources, so if people did want to make the choice to quit and stay in their units and keep them smoke-free, that would be great. We also, it's critical to have site champions, and this is a theme that went across all of our work. Having a resident or a property manager who felt passionate, just like our school superintendent did, is what it takes to make these kind of changes happen. And finally, focus staff. Now, we had about 1.5 FTE working on this project, and that might seem a lot for many health departments to devote to an effort of this scale, but we think that if you wanted to turn down the pace a little bit and make you could probably do this with just a half FTE and have significant success moving your affordable housing community towards becoming smoke-free. Now, why work with other sectors? What's in it for public health? What's in it for the other sectors? We've heard some of this from the other sectors, but I'd like to say from our perspective as a public health agency, we can't do everything it takes, obviously, to make all these changes in policy, systems, and environments. We lack the jurisdiction, and we lack the capacity and resources to make it happen. So we need to partner with those who do have the decision-making authority, whether it's in schools or transportation agencies or housing agencies, to work with them to figure out how their actions can make healthier communities. We also need to leverage our limited resources. These are tough times for doing public health work, and they're going to get tougher in terms of the fiscal resources we have available to us. But if we can leverage our work by working with and in partnership other community sectors, we can get the work done of building healthy communities. And I'll give some examples of that. Public health is also constrained in actually making policy change. We're a government agency, so as a public health official, I face the constraints of funding sources that don't let me lobby. I face the constraints of elected officials who put boundaries about what I can say and what I can do. And I face the need to be balanced as a publicly accountable official for all elements of our community. So public health really needs to make alliances and work closely with those advocates and activists in our community who can lobby, who can advocate forcefully, and can take on the tough issues that it take often means to make policy change. We've heard a lot in this talk, well, not in this talk, but in sessions about APHA, and I think this was mentioned as well by Becky and Ursula, the really good point that we need to avoid public health imperialism is what I call it. We cannot just be going to other sectors and lecturing them to say, do the right thing, do this for health. We need to replace this notion, which has gotten some pushback, at least in the realm we work with, of health in all policies, and replace it perhaps with making opportunities for healthy communities and what your sector can do to contribute to this. We really need to understand, as was clearly articulated by my fellow panelists, the other sector's interests. What is it that they want to accomplish, and how can public health help them reach their goals and produce as a co-benefit healthier communities? Then we need to build on the shared interest in healthy communities. Everybody wants to have their community be a healthy place. People see the social and moral good in that. And they also see by making healthier communities, their communities will be more desirable, will attract employers, will attract business, and will be good for their local economy. And we need to be able to offer something of value when we come to the table. So as we heard, the dollars from a big grant like CDPW definitely catch people's attention. But we also found is people were eager to get technical assistance in figuring out how to do what they wanted to do, but didn't necessarily know how to do. They wanted us to help with linking them to like-minded partners or resources and assets in the community that could make it happen. And so they saw other values besides just the money, and I think these will help us continue to leverage these relationships in the future. Let me give an example from one of our projects, our Healthy Corner Store project, about how some of these principles of working with other sectors played out. We are on the way to setting up 34 healthy corner stores in areas that lack access to fresh produce in an easy way for their residents. So we met with and have talked with small store owners and small businessmen. And really what they're interested in is they want more customers and they want their sales to go up. The bottom line is they are business people and that's what they have to do. They also want help in improving their store, making it look nicer and more attractive. And they also are committed to helping their community. Many of these store owners come from ethnic and cultural minorities, and they want to figure out how can I get culturally appropriate food that's healthy in my community to make my community healthier. From our perspective, we think that if we get more produce in the communities, people will eat more of it and will be healthier. This is actually a proposition that needs empirical validation, but it makes sense from a logical point of view. So we reached out and we found champions, store owners who want to be early adopters, like Sharik here, who's from one of our West Seattle stores, who has a halal market to sell to his Somali community. And we provided them with technical assistance. This includes coming up with marketing plans, business plans, how to store and protect and secure produce so it has good shelf life. How to link them up with produce suppliers. We worked with the produce suppliers to figure out how they could be more friendly to small businesses by smaller order sizes, by not requiring cash on delivery. And we helped with store upgrades, refrigeration equipment, painting and fixing up the facades to encourage more walk-in traffic and so on. But when we do healthy food work, and this is just one example of what we do, Many sectors are involved beyond small corner stores: schools, senior centers, childcare, faith-based organizations, food distributors, farmers. So we worked across all these sectors to increase access to healthy food. And one thing that's been important and a central role the health department could play is integrating and harmonizing this work. So we have now a set of nutrition guidelines that can work across all these sectors, so we're not making it up each time we go with a sector. That's a real efficiency and economy of scale doing work this way through multiple sectors. And we also are able to find opportunities to link sectors that haven't worked together before. An example is childcare and senior sites are now joining together to purchase healthy food, and by bulk purchasing are able to get more favorable prices and to make relationships with local farmers to bring farm-to-table programs to these. And these sectors have not really worked before, and particularly on food issues. So making multi-sector alliances to move things forward has been useful to us. Another example is our work in reducing consumption of sugary drinks and soda. So again, many sectors sell and have available these kind of products, and we can work with them in a coordinated way to reduce the availability of these products. The common framework here that lets us work across with and with multiple sectors is a sugary drink definition that everybody can use. Toolkits for simple ways to go soda-free, and model policies that people can adopt to make their institutions sugary drink-free. These methods of working with multiple sectors for us have come across both vertically and horizontally, and this has been a sort of a helpful conceptual framework for us. We're working with many communities across King County. We have 39 cities within the county, and we're working with the majority of them doing work in this arena right now. So within each suburban city, for example, or within Seattle, it's important to figure out how we can link the different organizations and agencies to work across their sectors to come up with reinforcing kind of products and activities. But we've also found it's really beneficial to coordinate and integrate the work across communities within a sector, so school districts from multiple sectors, so they can get together and think about best practices, and they can become a learning community, and they can develop policies in sync with each other. And it's important then there needs to be some glue in a community to make this integration within communities and across communities work. And an organization that has the trust and ability to mobilize, oftentimes that can be a local health department to make this happen, and certainly people have been receptive for us doing this work. Community engagement has been a big piece of what we've done with our work. We really want to engage community. So the question becomes, what does that mean? Who is the community? We've been successful in engaging many community-based organizations. A full two-thirds of the funds that we receive from CPW, we have in turn granted out through a RFP process or a direct funding process to community partners to get the work done. And they are great partners. They know their sectors, and they know how to get things done. That's been very beneficial to us. We have a community coalition that has 80 organizational members at this point, and about 150 people regularly turn up to our meetings to learn about, network, and move forward this policy systems and environment change agenda. Where we've been more challenged is working with the smaller community-based organizations, and perhaps those that particularly work with ethnic and cultural minority groups, because they are more on a service delivery and a program model, and the whole notion of doing PSC change is foreign to them. So we've tried to come up with some innovative ways to engage them in doing PSC work. For example, digital media projects where they can have their community members tell their stories about barriers or issues in their communities and what life is like, trying to make the healthy choice and what they see as ways to change their communities. We have tried to engage them in mobilizing community members around specific issues. So, for example, the Boys and Girls Clubs are organizing youth action teams to get rid of sugar and soda in the Boys and Girls Clubs and in other youth-serving areas. But it still is a challenge, I think, ahead to figure out what the best way to engage both residents and smaller CBOs in this kind of work and not have this turn into an exercise of speaking only with the elites, only with the policymakers, and having policy made by professionals done through pulling the levers of power without engaging communities. But this is an important next challenge, I think, to address. Perhaps one vehicle for doing this is to really invest in direct community organizing among residents so that they are empowered and have the leadership to be able to come to the table and make these decisions. There are a lot of tensions that we've experienced in doing this work. So it's not easy work, and we've had to strike a balance point, and I won't list them all. You can see them on the plan on the on this chart here, but I think being aware that you have to sort of figure out where you lie on many continuums as you do your work, and a lot of where you end up depends on your local political context and political windows of opportunity or chance encounters with the right person, but at the same time remaining core to the values and not drifting too far from those values of social justice, of changing communities and environments, and participatory democracy. So how are we going to move forward with CPPW in everyday public health practice? Well, one thing we've learned is that this is going to require our public health workforce to have a whole new set of skills. And training and capacity building in public health is important, but people are eager to learn these new sets of skills. Developing and implementing policy, creating systems change, institutional change, so getting out of your health department and working with other organizations and institutions to do this, policy change campaigns, media advocacy, figuring out how to leverage cross-sector partnerships, community organizing, and turning your assessment, community health assessment work, to focus on the policy environment and determinants of health in addition to behaviors and health outcomes. So I want to go back to this question that I started with as I'm ending here. Scalability is the key question. Is the work of CPPW able to be scaled down to the everyday work of public health? And I think the answer to that is yes. Take on fewer policy objectives, take more time to do it, but these can be done by relatively small investments to produce big changes. One of the ways this can happen is by sharing resources. I've been so amazed by my CPPW partners across the country and CDC and the technical assistance partners in what has been produced in 18 months. And CDC is going through a very systematic process right now, culling the best of the best of all these toolkits, media products, model policies, and so on, that can be used by local health departments across the country and help transform the way we do public health. So look to more on this, because I think there's so much we learn from each other and we can continue doing this. But to really make this happen, we need to build a movement. There is an emerging healthy communities movement that we can see right now spreading across the country. It focuses on the social and environmental determinants of health. It focuses on linking sectors. It's participatory and democratic, and it values equity and social justice. And we need this movement because we can learn from each other and build a learning community. We can support each other and provide ourselves moral support. And we can advocate more effectively for those changes we need to see at the federal level, as well as by changing the practices of corporations who have so much and increasing dominance and influence over our society. The only way we'll be able to be a countervailing force to corporate power and to affect federal policy is by joining in this work together. I had the opportunity, it was great, I urge everybody to go to the new MLK Memorial. This was one of the quotes they had on the wall, and I think it spoke really well to the task at hand, that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We're caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied into a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. We cannot move this agenda forward if we don't all join into the inescapable network of mutuality. Building a movement. There's a tool that we have available, just launched yesterday. I urge you guys to check out this website. This is a map of all the communities around the country that are advancing the movement right now. There are over 2,400 communities doing this kind of work. That is huge. What power do we have there? Huge power. So I will here's a real clear example that the movement is building. This was spontaneous graffiti we saw in Seattle. It was a Burger King ad talking about what you should have for your healthy meal at Burger King, and someone unbeknownst to us modified this to put the true message about what Burger King is doing. So this movement is spreading at the grassroots, and we as public health need to join with it and support it. And so I urge you all to advance the movement, go to that Community Commons website, and take us to the next level of doing this work. Thank you very much.
Thanks to all of our speakers this morning. Great presentations, and we do have time for questions, so I'd like to open the presentation up. We don't have a microphone in the room, so if you could stand and speak very loudly, we'll be able to get to your questions. Go ahead.
Thank you. I really want to thank the panel. I think this is a terrific example of multiple sectors coming together under the common banner of health and equity. It's terrific to see all these different sectors here. I think my question is actually for Dr. Bauer. The, you know, oftentimes policy environmental change takes longer than 2 years to achieve. And I'm wondering sort of what the CDC's expectations are for CPPW grantees, the local health departments in particular, and their funded partners, to sustain their work beyond a two-year period, particularly those that did not earn a community transformation grant, given that a lot of times they, achieving those sort of ambitious goals within a two-year time frame is not realistic in some communities. So I was wondering what the CDC's
Yeah, great question. Thanks. So the question, if you didn't hear it, is how do we keep the momentum going post-CPPW funding now that the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds have been spent? How do communities continue to do this work? So there's a couple different answers to that. One is, one of the things that we hope to accomplish with communities putting prevention to work is a new way of working in communities and across the country to advance health. And I think we heard a lot of good examples today that is really happening, and that new approach to advancing health will be institutionalized, has been established, and will continue to be effective over the long term. Obviously, we also heard today that funding helps, and we invested substantial funding in the Communities Putting Prevention to Work grantees. You will notice that with the community transformation grants that were announced in September, funding levels were substantially lower, on the average of about $1 per capita, unlike the $2 to $4 to $10 per capita that we were able to invest in some CPPW communities. That does reflect both a change in the resources that we have available, but also a recognition that in order to scale a program like CPPW nationally, we're just not going to have the resources to cover the entire country. And that is the goal of community transformation grants, that every area will eventually get a community transformation grant. So as the Prevention and Public Health Fund grows, and it will continue to grow until it reaches the $2 billion point, we hope that the investment in community transformation grants will also grow, and that we will be able to fund additional communities over time. Question here. Sure, I will defer to Dr. Bunnell, and I think we should use the microphone so people can hear the answer.
Yeah, and I want to recognize our full team, because there are a lot of people. In fact, Becky Payne is the acting program director for CPPW, Carolyn Brooks, John Francis, Wendy Hirett, and a number of other folks in the room are really the ones who've done all the work from the CDC side, Robin Soler, on CPPW, so just wanted to recognize them. We are putting together and trying to compile those resources. They will be up on the website that I flashed at the end there. And if you go to that, we'll also be linking you to others. So I would put that as our point of contact, information. We are also trying to, of course, build from CPPW to support the community transformation grant process going forward, and draw also from the REACH communities, the healthy communities, and other things that CDC has, other communities that CDC has supported over the last decade.
Okay, we have a question over here.
At the heart of the exercise issue in many low-income communities is crime. I'm just wondering if any of the panelists have done any initiatives to increase safety so people can exercise.
Patrick, I think that was something that you might have mentioned.
Couple things I would mention quickly. One is in our physical design of our developments, we've spent a lot of time thinking about the open space. And in many old public housing developments, the open space was sort of shunted off to the side, or the buildings backed up onto the parks. And what we have done in the urban design is put the park as center. I talked about a living room right in the middle of the development, surrounded by public streets, well lit, jam-packed with activities, activities for a range of age groups. So it's young kids, teenagers, parents, then seniors can all enjoy the open space. And then have the buildings, the housing surrounding the open space so that people that are within the buildings can really keep an eye on what's happening. We have found that that makes the space more inviting. And when the space is more inviting, there are more people there, and that's the biggest deterrent to crime. Tell you one additional story. I mentioned the Boys and Girls Club also. We did a development where there is a Boys and Girls Club main club probably about two blocks away from our 256 units of housing. But what we were finding was that none of our residents were going to that particular clubhouse because that clubhouse was the territory, if you will, of another group of kids, and there were forever conflicts between. Working with the Boys and Girls Club, they did what they call a shared club facility. And what this is a much smaller version of the clubhouse. It doesn't have the gym and the pool and all of that sort of stuff, but it's got exercise room and computer rooms and after-school programming. And it's really aimed at kids that are from 8 to like 15 or 16 years of age, with the thought being that they become inculcated in the Boys and Girls Clubhouse system. And through the passage of time and over generations, they'll become more comfortable with going to the larger facility. It's been interesting that clubhouse being on site in our property has meant that the parents have become much more active than they would have been had the facility been located off-site. So those are a couple of things that we have done that I think have been successful in that realm.
If I could add quickly, I'd like to join Patrick. It is about design and taking that issue of a per-project basis. One of the things that cities can do is to look at urban design guidelines. So you create the same sort of windows on the street for every building across the city. What you do is you reinforce your streets as public space, not as private space. And all the open spaces that we're sort of talking about building can have that same opportunity. You can take that down to design of individual buildings. One of the big things that active design guidelines can do is to create stairs that are usable, safe, and obvious. And I know it's the dumbest thing in the world, but it really works, is to make your stair first. You know, you find the stair before you find the elevator, but those stairs have to be safe and open. So through good design, you can actually embellish the idea of the building with expressing the stair on the outside. So you get lots of daylight, and you can see everybody coming and going.
Right, a question in the back. Great question. So Patrick, on the business case, and Jim, maybe you want to address that too with the store initiative.
I would say the business case has a few things that I would point to. I start with the notion that if there's something that can be done that will reduce my operating costs, I'm all in favor of that. And what we were talking about before, in terms of crime, It's probably the single biggest line item in my budget. And again, this is whether I'm doing something that's high-end or something that is affordable. But if it's an urban, it's a dense urban location where people are bumping into each other, I'm spending a lot of money out of my operating budget for crime. And if I can reduce that through design measures or other things, collaborations with social service organizations, that's going to help my bottom line. The second thing that I've realized is that it's responding to the need. You know, I mentioned before that when we were doing a lot of our developments, we had a tendency to put carpeting in. Carpeting is affordable, it's easy to replace, on and on and on and on. We also found that, again, across the economic spectrum, that residents have more of an interest, not just for aesthetic reasons, but for health reasons. They want products that are not friable, like carpeting is. And that enables me to attract residents in marketplaces where other people are doing things that are lesser of quality and meeting less the market need. The big eye-opener for us was the big development, again, a market-rate development that we did in downtown Boston that went smoke-free housing. And we found many high-end renters that have an opportunity to rent anywhere in the city choosing to live there because they know that they didn't have to wrestle with secondhand smoke coming from the apartment that is next door. So that was a marketing advantage as we look to lease up that building in tough economic times.
I think the ROI question is very important. I'll follow up. Another ROI from as we've approached property managers is the maintenance of houses that have smokers in them, the units with smokers, is high. And so they've seen dramatically decreased maintenance costs as these units have gone smoke-free. The appeal to the small business owner in our Healthy Corner stores is that they're going to increase profits. And they expect to do this, and we're actually going to help them evaluate to try to understand what happens to their sales and customer base and understand more quantitatively what that's going to be. And then I think even when you get out of the dollars and cents type of return on investment, the appeal to educators, for example, is test scores are the coin of the realm there, not dollars. And there's emerging evidence that you can show that kids who are more physically active and eat better foods actually have better academic performance, and that can increase their test scores, which in turn can translate into revenues for them and other benefits from their school district. So I think you're right, there has to be a theme to sell this. I also think we have to understand that there are more benefits in life than dollars and cents, and that's what public health has traditionally been good at, and we do not forget to give that message at the same time we show the fiscal impact of what we do.
In terms of the larger question in CDC, I think the crux of what we're trying to do through programs like CPPW and through our broad chronic disease portfolio is deliver healthier kids to our schools, deliver healthier workers to our businesses and employers, and deliver a healthier population to the healthcare system. And healthcare costs are of great interest to our businesses and employers right now. They're of great interest to our budget planners in Congress. They are driving substantially the debt and the deficit that we're struggling with as a nation right now. So one business case for businesses and employers is how improved health, reduced smoking rates, reduced obesity rates, better control of blood pressure and diabetes, for example, do lead to increased worker productivity on the job, fewer sick days off the job that you are likely paying for, and then dramatically reduced health care costs as a result of that healthier workforce. So that's the broader argument that we're making. We need to connect all of the dots to show that investments in programs like Communities Putting Prevention to Work and Community Transformation Grants actually lead to those healthier populations. I think that our time is up, but you've been a terrific audience, and one more round of applause for our great panel.